This sermon is from the series Esther, Trusting the Unseen God, preached at Crossway Church in Battleground, Washington.
When have you had a hard time waiting for something important? Now, I will be the first to admit I am not good on patience. But when you have to sit there and wait for something, it can be hard. Maybe you're waiting, you remember waiting in a waiting room, waiting for your loved one to come out of surgery, knowing how they're going to be. Maybe you're waiting to see how you did on an important test or to wait to see how your review is going to happen at work. Maybe you're waiting for a promotion or a transfer. Maybe you're waiting for something relationally. You're waiting for a son or a daughter to come and make amends and to have a conversation with them and to be able to repair things. Maybe you're waiting for someone to date and you're just waiting for that right person. Let's admit, waiting isn't fun, and it can create kind of an internal anguish in us. Well, today we're going to continue our sermon series in the book of Esther. If you're newer here, we just like to preach through a book, and we have chosen to preach through the book of Esther, and we find ourselves in Esther 5. And we are going to look at the entire chapter, and we're kind of in a little bit of a waiting period. When we ended, things weren't very good. Haman had convinced the king to have an edict to basically wipe out the entire Jewish people. And in last week's chapter, we see that Mordecai and Esther, although Esther did it a little bit begrudgingly at first, but came around to see that God had put her in this spot, in her throne for a purpose, had a plan. And the plan was that they were going to have all the Jewish people pray and fast for 3 days, and then she was going to go before the king. Now, if you remember, she was actually putting her life at risk. If we've seen anything about the king Xerxes, is that he is a little bit impulsive. I mean, in chapter 1, the first thing that we saw him do is he got rid of a queen because she refused to come before him and show off her good looks to the people around him after he and his compadres had a little too much to drink after many days of partying. And so we've also seen that he's impulsive of going in for Haman and just wiping out a group of people. And we know that Esther said it, that if she goes before the king and he is not favorable to her, that she not only risks the lives of the Jews, but her own life as well, because he could easily take her out, as that is the custom. And so hopefully now our waiting is going to be over. And we will turn to Esther 5, verses 1 through 8 is what I'm going to read at first, and then we'll look at the other section after that. On the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the palace in front of the king's hall. And the king was sitting on his royal throne in the hall, facing the entrance. And when he saw Queen Esther standing in the court, he was pleased with her and held out to her the gold scepter that was in his hand. So Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter. Then the king asked, "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? Even up to half the kingdom, it will be given to you." "If it pleases the king," replied Esther, "let the king, together with Haman, come today to a banquet I have prepared for him." "Bring Haman at once," the king said, "so that we may do what Esther asks." So the king and Haman went to the banquet Esther had prepared, and as they were drinking wine, the king asked Esther, "Now, what is your petition? It will be given you. What is your request? Even up to half the kingdom, it will be granted." Esther replied, "My petition and my request is this. If the king regards me with favor, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and fulfill my request, let the king and Haman come tomorrow to the banquet, and I prepare for them, and then I will answer the king's question." Well, it's the moment we've been waiting for. What's going to happen? Last week, we wondered if Esther would have the courage to go before the king, and what we see here today is she does exactly that. You can only imagine what she's feeling as she's putting on her royal robes. Is this the last day that she's going to live? Is this the last day, at the very least, that she'll have this position of privilege, knowing that if the king looks at her unfavorably, he could either kill her or at the very least depose her like he did Vashti? We knew that both of those things are a really good possibility. And so Esther is sitting there, I'm sure, in a moment of wondering what's going to happen next. Now, it's interesting that it says that they put on her royal robes, and I think one of the reasons why she did it is because she wanted to remind everyone of her position as the queen. She was going to come forth in front of the king, and it's her way of not only reminding him, but the people around him of her royal status. It would remind him that he chose her to be his queen out of all the women in all of the kingdom. And so what we see here, though, is that her courage that she had started off with is building, and she actually follows through and she does this. Now, it's interesting here that he actually, this is a monograph of the actual Persian ruler's throne room. It's a carving that's done, and you'll see the scepter is right there. And if you look behind him, there's also some people with some arrows and an axe. And so the threat is definitely real. I think the description that we see here is accurate. Well, good news, right off the bat, what we see is that King Xerxes sees her, and rather than taking offense that somebody would go against his authority or do something that he didn't expect, it seems like he's been a little big on that with his ego. It's all about people obeying him. He has a disposition in which he invited her in to the room, the throne room, and offers to help. Matter of fact, if we read it, it says, hey, I'll give you half your kingdom. Now, here we're at this moment of Esther fearing for her life, and the first words that the king mutters is, come in, and whatever your request is, it must be important because you just wouldn't show up in your royal robes for no reason. What is it? I will answer it. Now, the scholars debate about this phrase, I'll give you up to half the kingdom. Did he really mean it, or was it an idiom that was used just to say, whatever you're looking for, I'll try and help you out? But either way, what we're seeing is movement in a positive direction. Esther risks her life, the king welcomes her in, and what we see is the king is disposed to help her and invites to offer her help. Now, at this moment, I would think, man, could things have gotten any easier? I mean, this is like a fastball down the middle. This is an easy pitch. All Esther has to do is ask, and she's going to get what she wants. But it seems that Esther has a different plan. She's at work here. And rather than just laying out what her ultimate request is, which is to ask that he spare her people, instead, Esther asks that the king and Haman come to a banquet. Now, I want you to imagine what it would be like for Esther to have to invite the person who sent the edict to kill all your people and have dinner with them. That's not a dinner I would like to attend. That's not the person I would be excited to have come before me. But she does it. And again, what we see is that she invites them to the king and Haman to a banquet. Now, again, we see that the king comes, and after a bunch of wine, we see that he again offers the exact same question. Esther, I know that something is bothering you. You wouldn't have just come into my presence dressed in all your royal garb for nothing. So whatever it is, I will give you half the kingdom. Again, we sit here and we wonder, like, what is going on with Esther here? I mean, the king twice asks her what to do. Part of me wonders if it's like nerves, you know? I mean, is it nerves here that she's asking it? Is she like a teenage boy who is nervous about calling and asking out his first aid? I can remember the first one I did. Thankfully, they didn't have caller ID back in that day. You know, I dialed a couple of numbers and then hung up before it got there, dialed all nine and let it ring once and then did it. And then a few minutes later, finally got it all the way up and boom, the person answered. Is this what's going on in Esther? I mean, is she just so nervous that she has a banquet and then kind of pushes it off? To be honest with you, I don't think that's what's going on at all. I think there's a cunningness to Esther. I think there's a wisdom to Esther. See, we've already seen that the king is impulsive. We've seen that the king will just do something without much thought. And so I think what she's doing is testing the king's motives. Okay, you saw me, you think highly of me, and you pretend that you'll do anything. I bring you to a banquet. I invite you to come there. You say again, whatever as you want. But that's all in the matter of the same day. Are you really disposed to do this big ask that I'm going to do to save my people? And so what you see is that she invites him to a second banquet. And she says, if you're really favorably predisposed to me, if you really are willing to answer what it is I ask for, as you've said twice, well, then come to my banquet. In some senses, it's a way for the king to get out of this. If he doesn't really want to do it, well, then he just doesn't show up, or he could decline the offer. But if he says yes to the second banquet, well, then Esther knows that there's a very good chance that he will do what he says, that it's not just impulse, but there's a greater desire for him to do what she asks. After all, she had kind of lost favor with him. He hadn't called for her for 30 days, and so she needed to test this. Well, I think this is important for us because it's a good reminder for us that we need to be wise in the way that we engage with others. There's a wisdom here in the way that Esther does it. Jesus says, I'm sending you out as sheep among the wolves, therefore be as shrewd as snakes and as innocent as doves. And in 1 Peter 2, he says, live such good lives among the pagans that although they accuse you of doing wrong, they see your good deeds and glorify God on the day that he visits. And I think Esther is living in this tension. She is trying to be as innocent or as holy, for lack of a better term, as she can be. She's trying to do the right thing. And she's trying to be honoring to the king, kind of sitting there and waiting. But she's also being cunning and shrewd. She's testing his true motives. Is this really a sincere request? Or is this just fueled by liquor and hormones and the impulsiveness of King Xerxes? And when we engage with people, Jesus says that we need to be the same way, that we need to do things like be kind to them, not be the calm and non-reactive presence, the listening ear, the helpful hand of all these in times of need. All of these things are kind of that being the innocent, being the good, the common good to people around us. But there's also a shrewdness, a cunningness that we can have. And I don't mean that in a bad way, but rather, you know, Esther walked into the presence of the king and she invited him to these banquets. And we can be wise too as we engage with the people around us. You know, we can ask really deep, piercing questions. And rather than just have surfacey conversations, we can even admit our own brokenness to people and admit things that we struggle with. And in doing so, we can show people both a fortitude of something that's different than the world around us, and also open the doors to maybe even sharing our faith through even the brokenness that we have or the way that we steer conversations, asking them about the way their life is going. It's not a malicious thing. It's not a terrible thing where we want to just kind of take advantage of people, but it's rather because we care about them that we want to live out the gospel. But we also want to be smart about how we engage in the gospel with them. And so I think that this tension that Esther lives in, this being wise and semi-direct, but yet kind of checking things out, is a good practice for us as we engage with the world around us as well. So that's where we sit, hoping that maybe we can have to be patient once again. Because guess what? It doesn't get wrapped up at the end of this chapter. We don't get to the second banquet. We don't get to find out what's going on. Instead, where the author of Esther takes us is to the evil villain, Haman. And what we're going to do in our next section is see a little bit more about him. And in fact, we're going to see his anger. Now, Haman went out on that day happy and in high spirits. But when he saw Mordecai at the king's gate and observed that he neither rose nor showed fear in his presence, he was filled with rage against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home. Calling together his friends and Zeresh, his wife, Haman boasted to them about his vast wealth, his many sons, and all the ways that the king had honored him and how he had elevated him among all the other nobles and officials. And that's not all, Haman added. I am the only person that Queen Esther invited to accompany the king to the banquet she gave. And she has invited me along with the king tomorrow. But all this gives me no satisfaction as long as I see that Jew Mordecai sitting at the king's gate. But his wife Zeresh and all her friends said to him, have a pole set up, reaching to the heights of 50 cubits, and ask the king in the morning to have Mordecai impaled on it, and then go with the king to the banquet and enjoy yourself. Now this suggestion delighted Haman, and he had a pole set up. Well, just when it seems like things are going great, and Esther's about ready to ask her question to the king before the banquet, what we see is the anger, Haman's anger and his rage against Mordecai keeps on raging, and we're left with a cliffhanger. A pole is set up, and he wants to go before the banquet to kill Esther's adopted father, her cousin, Mordecai. And so we're going to have to wait and see. But there's some things that we have to notice in this passage that I think are important. And the first one is this, is that Haman is high on his own power and status. I mean, Esther 9 notes that he went out that day happy and in high spirits. And I don't think he was just drunk on wine. I think he was drunk on his own pride and his own self-righteousness and his own sense of elevated status. Because that's all he highlights in the text later on. But it's amazing to see how he responds when there is one person. I mean, think about this. Haman is walking through the streets, and the king has said that everybody must bow down in front of him. And as he's walking, everybody is bowing down and honoring him. And you could easily see, well, there's 9,000 people, just for an instance, let's say. It's a parade. The harvest day is a battleground. And as he's walking through the parade, everybody but one person is bowing. You could think, wow, that's a pretty good number. That's 99.9%. But that's not what Haman focuses on. Haman sees that one person, Mordecai, and it ruins Haman's joy. We see it here. He says that he was filled with anger against Mordecai because he didn't rise and he didn't show him fear in his presence. Remember, Mordecai knows that Haman is the one who created the edict to eradicate all the Jews, and he knew that it was because of Mordecai's actions. And yet, what we see in this little line right here is that Mordecai actually believed what he said last chapter, that if God doesn't use Esther to save his people, ultimately he would save them through another means. That quiet confidence, that is what set
Haman
off. And so what we see is Mordecai's next step is when your ego is dented, well, bring in everybody who agrees with you. And so he calls in his wife and his friends to repair his dented ego. He starts off by trying to repair it himself and reminding them about his high status. I mean, he says, look, I'm wealthy, I'm rich, I have all these sons. Look at all the way the king has honored me and how he's elevated me above everyone. And if that wasn't even good enough, the queen honors me too. There's two people she invites to a banquet. It's me and the king. I mean, look at how great I am. And that's what he spends his time doing with his friends. Begs the question to us, what are those things that we brag about? What are those things that we hang on to as our accomplishments? But then he comes and he's real with his friends. He admits that his heart is hollow because Mordecai won't bow down to him. He says, all this gives me no satisfaction as long as I see that Jew Mordecai sitting on the king's gates. It's easy to judge
Haman,
isn't it? I mean, it's easy to stand from afar and say, man, you have everything, and this one guy is setting you off and making you angry. But yet at the same time, when we look at a text like this, of somebody who sees all these things that are going well, and all of a sudden there's this one thing that ruins his joy, if we think of it in that kind of a context, well, I don't know about you, but that hurts a little bit because that's a little bit more closer to my real life than I would care to admit. I love this quote by an author named Gavin Ortland in his book, Humility, the Joy of Self-Forgetfulness. He says, "Pride grumbles at everything, but humility can joyfully receive life as a gift." Haman could have easily looked at all the other people who were around him bowing down to him. He could have looked at his wealth. He could have looked at all these things, and it could have been perceived as a gift. But instead, the one thing that didn't go his way ruined his joy. And he says, "My life is hollow. My life is empty until I get this." And again, here, I think if we think about it in terms of that, well, then that speaks to my own heart of what can easily happen there. Now, so the question that we can maybe ask about is, what do we grumble about? What are those things that steal our joy? What are those things that when we go through life and it seems like it's in a good place, just like this, have the ability to turn our mood 180 degrees? There's a deeper thing that's below the surface that we'll look at here in a second, and I think that's a question we got to ask ourselves. Hopefully, Haman forces us to do that. What is the deeper thing going below it? But before we do that, we'll see what not to do. Because his wife recommends that rather than dealing with what's going on deep within Haman's soul, why is that one guy bothers you so much? What is it about him? Instead, she says, well, just deal with the surface issue. Go deal with it. You don't like this guy? He's ticking you off? Well, eliminate the 0.0001%. Then everybody will bow down to you. Just set up that pole. Tell the king to impale him. Or maybe even it could be crucifixion. That word is a little bit unclear. But get rid of him and make a spectacle so everybody knows that you are wealthy, you are powerful, and it's you and the king. You see how it feeds into this thing? Just get rid of the issue and show everybody else that everything that you just stated about yourself is true by getting rid of him. As I said, I think it's good for us to look at Haman. It's easy for us just to say, you know what? His character is so out there. I don't have that wealth. I don't have that power. Me and the President of the United States are not tight. We're not besties. He doesn't listen to me. So what does Haman have to do with me? But again, if we look at it in terms of having happiness and having it removed quickly because of something, well, then if we look at it and we look at it from that perspective, well, then I am more like Haman than I would care to admit. There are things that can control my heart, those things that I like to call as idols because I've been influenced by the work of Tim Keller and others, Paul David Tripp. But those things in our own heart that we look to below the that are often below the surface that we don't see or we don't take the time to examine, that can control our own hearts more than we care to admit. And so when we look at a guy like Haman, rather than dismissing him and saying, I don't want to be, I'm not like him at all, rather what we can do is let the scriptures be a mirror into our own souls and admit that I can be as fickle sometimes, that I can let certain things steal my own joy more than I care to admit. And so the question that we can ask ourselves is, what are those things that control me? And the way that we can get to it is some of those questions that I asked you. What is it that makes you grumble? What is it that makes you proudful? Because those things often show the things that are lurking behind our heart that want to control it more than we care to admit. I love this definition of idol. It's in your notes. So is the Gavin Ortland quote, by the way, if you have the sermon notes either online or in our bulletin. But it says this, an idol is whatever you look at and say in your heart of hearts, if I have that, then I'll feel like my life has meaning and I'll know that I have value. And then I'll feel significant and secure. What does Haman says? Haman says, if everyone in the entire nation, not a single person, bow down and worships me and gives me the proper honor and respect, Well, then I'll be happy. Now, I look at that and go, you're ridiculous, man. I mean, you have 99.99999% of the people who are bowing down to you. You are have the great wealth. You have the seat of honor next to the king. You're second in command, and you're going to get stuck on one person? That one person's lack of honor is going to steal your joy? But see, Haman's not happy until he gets everyone. Because that one person who doesn't show him the respect or the honor that he speaks is that voice inside of his head that says, you don't really measure up. And so what does he want to do? He wants to eradicate it. Rather than embracing kind of the hurt and acknowledging it, to admit that maybe he's put more stock on all of this than he would care to admit, he just gets rid of the nuisance for now. But here's the thing about idols. They always pop up. If it isn't Mordecai, somebody else will give him a different look and set him off. And the same thing is true for us. If we just deal with the surfacey issues, if we just try and make our life comfortable, or if we just get into another relationship and we feel that feeling right off the bat, that kind of infatuation says where it seems like there, if we think that we can just get the applause of one more person, whether it be our parent or our spouse or our loved ones, then we'll feel better about ourselves. The fact of the matter is that our life will never be completely comfortable. Matter of fact, Jesus says the opposite. That we're going to have to pick up our cross and follow him. And there will be pain and there will be suffering. We know that our relationships will never be what they are supposed to be. Why? Because every relationship is full of two broken people. Them and me. And we will never get the ultimate applause from other people. Because living up to other people's standards is this thing that we'll never, ever achieve. And so I think even this little glimpse of Haman reminds us of this truth. That it's easy for us to give up our joy. It's easy for us to pursue these things that have a underlying control of us more than we would ever care to admit. But there is also a powerful statement that I think we see here. And that is that this story should remind us that Christ's grace frees us. Now, I hinted at it in the way that Mordecai acted, right? I mean, it says right there in the text that Mordecai has no fear. And his fear is because he trusts that God is a God who keeps his promises. And we as believers know that God's ultimate promise that he kept is that someday he would send a Savior who would deal with our sin. And what we see is that Christ's grace frees us. At first, we can see, I think in the book of Esther, a comparison. The first thing that we see is that we can be thankful that we can enter into God's throne room without fear because of the work of Christ. Esther put on her robes, not wondering if the king would even welcome her in or if she would face death. But you and I serve the almighty creator of the universe, who's king of it all. And what the scriptures tell us is that if we put our hope and trust in Jesus, that we can enter into his throne room without fear. Not because we put on the great garb and we dress ourselves up in making ourselves look good, but rather it's the exact opposite. It comes from admitting our brokenness, admitting that we are ungodly, as it said in Romans in our assurance today, and that we are powerless and that we are sinners. But it is exactly in that state that Christ embraces us. Hebrews 4 tells us this. Therefore, since we have a great high priest who has ascended into heaven, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold firmly to the faith that we profess. For we do not have a high priest who's unable to empathize with our weakness, but we have one who's been tempted in every way, just as we are, yet he did not sin. Now let us then approach God's throne of grace with confidence, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need. Do you see those things in tension? It is that we are weak and that we are tempted and that we often give in to these things. But Jesus Christ did not do that. He lived a sinless life. And because he lived a sinless life, we can then approach God's throne of grace, not in fear, but in confidence. Confidence that we come not in the power of our own righteousness or having life figured out or in our own sinlessness, but rather the righteousness of Christ. And so when we read Esther's fear, it should remind us and make us thankful that our God does not operate like Xerxes, but rather he provided us a way to enter his throne room confidently. But what we also need to see is that Christ's grace frees us from the judgment of others and ourselves. Haman was being judged by Mordecai, and it didn't get what he wanted it to, and it ruined his joy. And here's the thing about the gospel, is it not only allows us to have a relationship with God, but the more that we allow it to impact our lives, the more that we allow what God thinks of us more than what other people think of us, or the more that we trust God's plan for our lives rather than our own lives, well, then it frees us to have a sense of joy that is greater than the circumstances around us. It's not based on people's standards or our self-esteem. I mean, if there's a little book that I've been influenced on here, I'm just going to lay the disclaimer. I don't have any quotes in here because I just quote the whole book. And it is thin, like that thin, okay? It's called The Freedom of Self-Forgetfulness, and it's by Tim Keller. And basically, his whole theory on this is that the more we are focused on Christ, the more that we allow what he says and what he accomplished in our lives to reign over us and to dictate what we are, we're free from others' judgments and the judgments of ourselves. In Haman's case, the thing that caused him a lack of joy was the judgment of Mordecai, and it ruined him. And for some of us, that's what it takes. I mean, we are similar. If it is one of our loved ones gives us a cross look, or if one of our kids isn't acting the way that we want them to, we take that personally. If our boss doesn't give us the approval that we think we need, or our parents don't speak the words of affirmation that we think we deserve, all of those things can eat at us because it feels like we're not living up to the judgment, their judgment. And for some of us, it's not the judgment of others, it's our own judgment that eats us alive. We think that we need to live a certain way, and when we don't and we measure up, we feel the weight of this. But the Apostle Paul talks about a life that's so gripped by the gospel that he's freed from those things. In 1 Corinthians 4, verse 2 through 4, he says, "Now it is required that those who have been given a trust must prove faithful. But I care very little if I'm judged by you or any human court. Indeed, I don't even judge myself because my conscience is clear, but that does not make me innocent. It is the Lord who judges me." And here's the truth of the gospel. The more that we understand that God knows that we are sinners and yet died for us and gives us grace, and when that fills our hearts and it fills our emotions and everything we have within us, well then quite frankly, the impact of all these other things, they become minor annoyances rather than things that steal our joy. I mean, here's the trick. We give power to people more than we care to admit. I mean, I can give somebody the power to have their comment totally destroy me, or I can listen to the voice of grace that says, God, the creator of the entire universe, embraces me and loves me. Now, it doesn't mean that I still don't live the holy life. We saw that in the book of Esther. But this knowing that there's the tension of my sin and God's embrace frees me because it's his voice that I listen to the loudest. And so the others kind of fade into the distance. And the more that we can do that, the freer we will be. I've used this illustration before. Sorry, it's just so good. But when I did teach one to lead one over at Battleground Public School for, I don't know, 5 or 6 years, we played this game called The Voice of Truth. And in it, we set up this thing. We got somebody, we put a blindfold on them, we spun them around, put them in a corner, let them get a little undizzy after that. And then what we did is we created an obstacle path around them. And they had to try and make it from one corner to the next. But here's the trick. One person was tasked with telling them the correct directions. Head left, head straight, head right. Now half the time they had to like go, okay, it's from your perspective, not mine. That was the tricky part. But also, they had 30 kids yelling out the exact opposite. And here's the way it worked. The kids that just listened to the wrong voices or listened to the entire crowd, they ran into everything. And it was painful, and they got frustrated, and they stopped. But if one kid could figure out who that one person was that was leading them correctly, and if they could phase out that entire voice, they rocked it. I mean, they rocked it. And what Haman reminds us of is if we listen to all these voices, whether they're outside or inside our own mind and our own emotions, or if we listen to the voices of culture or other people's judgments of us, we're going to run into all kinds of things and our life is going to hurt because our joy is going to be stolen. The more that we allow God's voice to be that dominant voice of truth in our own lives, it doesn't mean that life is going to go easy. It doesn't mean that we're not going to have trials. It doesn't mean that our joy is going to be, our happiness is going to be threatened. But there will be a deeper joy, a joy that is at work in our lives that is regardless of our circumstances. This is the joy that we all want to have, isn't it? And the way that we do it is to not be like Haman and deal with just surfacey issues, but rather embrace the grace that Jesus has already given us.
You have just watched a sermon from Crossway Church in Battleground, Washington. We hope that you enjoyed it, and we'd love to have you come join us for a worship service on Sunday at 10 a.m. at 311 North Parkway Avenue in Battleground, Washington. If you'd like to find more information about us online, you can find it at crosswaychurchwa.com.